The Positive Effects of Giving Charity.
A long time ago, her son went missing from her. He was gone for so long a time that she finally lost all hope of ever seeing him again. One day, she sat down to eat, breaking off a piece of bread from a nearby loaf. She was about to put it into her mouth when all of a sudden, a beggar appeared at her door and asked her to feed him. Not only did she give him the remaining part of the loaf of bread, but she also gave him the morsel that she was about to put into her mouth. Putting the loaf back together as best as she could, she handed it over to the beggar, and since she herself was relatively poor, she remained hungry for the rest of the day. After a few days passed, her son returned, and they both rejoiced at their meeting. They sat down together, and he began to give an account of the many hardships he endured since the time he had gone missing. He said, "Perhaps the worst thing that happened to me occurred when I was walking in the valleys of such and such place only a few days ago. A lion approached, and instead of trying to attack the donkey that I was riding upon, it leapt straight at me, throwing me off of my mount. As fast as it could, the donkey raced off, and I was left as easy prey for the lion. It began to tear away at my clothes with its ferocious claws. I was so afraid that I almost fainted. The lion then leaned over me, getting ready for a lethal strike. But a huge man, whose face and garments were both white, suddenly appeared and drew the lion's attention away from me. He came, and without the use of any weapons, he pulled the lion away from me and wrestled it to the ground. Then, looking at the lion with a menacing expression, he said, 'Stand, O dog, a morsel for a morsel.' The lion immediately got up and raced away. After seeing the lion speed away, I returned my gaze to the man, but he was no longer there, and I couldn't find him afterwards. I stayed where I was for a number of hours until my strength returned to me. Realizing that the lion had done no harm to my body, I got up and walked away until I joined up with a traveling party. I told my story to them, but there is one part of it that I was, and still am, extremely confused about. What did the man mean when he said, 'a morsel for a morsel?'" At this point, during the narrative, his mother stared straight ahead of her with an incredulous expression, realizing that the man came to save her son at approximately the exact same time that she had given up her morsel of bread to the beggar.
Unparalleled generosity.
Abdullah ibn Ja'far, radiyallahu anhu, was so famous for his generosity that he became known by the title Father of the Poor. One day, he walked by a garden and saw in it a slave harvesting dates. At that very same moment, the son of the slave's owner came, bringing with him two loaves of bread. The slave took them and then sat down to eat. But before he could eat even a morsel of bread, he saw a dog approaching in his direction and a pitiable state of health. The dog was moaning and wagging its tail. The slave threw one of the two loaves in the direction of the dog, which immediately pounced upon the bread and ate it up. It was not satisfied, however, for it approached nearer, still wagging its tail. To Abdullah ibn Ja'far's great surprise, for he was watching all of this from a distance, the slave then threw the second loaf of bread in the direction of the dog, which proceeded to quickly eat it up. The slave then stood and continued with his daily labor. Amazed by what he saw, Abdullah ibn Ja'far, radiyallahu anhu, approached the slave and addressed him. "What amount of food are you given each day?" "Only that which you saw," said the slave. "Then why did you give both of the loaves to the dog?" asked Abdullah, radiyallahu anhu. "Indeed, Our land is not one that is inhabited by dogs. And so I knew that the dog must have come this far only because of hunger, and that is why I preferred it to my own self. Then what will you do about yourself for the rest of your day? I will go hungry this night, said the slave. Abdullah ibn Ja'far radiyallahu anhu then said to himself, the people censure me for my generosity, yet this slave is more generous than I am. He then went to the owner of the slave and asked to purchase him. The owner asked, and why do you want to buy him? Abdullah ibn Ja'far then informed him about everything that he had witnessed. He explained that he wished to buy him only so that he could then free him. He also voiced his intention of buying the garden and giving it to him as a gift. The owner said, you want to do all of that for him simply based on the one deed that you witnessed from him? Indeed, we witness wonderful acts from him every single day. I bear witness that he is indeed free for the countenance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and that the garden is a gift from me to him.
The most just, the most merciful.
It is related that a woman once went to the Prophet David, alayhi salam, and said, O Prophet of Allah, is your Lord just or unjust? David, alayhi salam, said, Woe unto you, woman, indeed, he is most just and never acts unjustly. He then asked her, What is your story? She said, I am a widow. I have 3 daughters, and I provide for them from what I spin with my needle and yarn. Yesterday, I wrapped my yarn in a cloth and went with it to the marketplace, intending to sell it and use the proceeds to buy provisions for my children. But while I was walking to the marketplace, a bird suddenly swooped down and took my yarn and my cloth, after which it flew away. I sat there in a sad and miserable state, faced with the reality that I owned nothing that I could use to provide for my children. As the woman was with David, alayhi salam, telling him her story, someone knocked on the door, asking permission to enter. 10 men then entered. Each one was a businessman, and each one had 100 dinars in his hand. They said, O Prophet of Allah, give this money to someone who is deserving of it. David, alayhi salam, asked, What prompted you to bring this money here? They said, O Prophet of Allah, we were traveling in a sea vessel when the waves began to roar tempestuously and our ship began to sink. Then suddenly, as if out of nowhere, a bird came and dropped a red cloth that contained yarn inside of it. Using those materials, we quickly worked to repair the hole in the ship that was causing us to sink. Not much time passed before the winds and waves calmed down and the hole was repaired. We then made an oath to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that each one of us would give 100 dinars in charity. This is that money, which you may give as charity to whomsoever you please. Turning to the woman, David, alayhi salam, said, A Lord who does business for you on land and in the sea, yet you make him out to be unjust. He gave her the entire 1,000 dinars and said, Spend it on your children.
Another story about the positive effects of giving charity.
The governor of Egypt once summoned Ibn al-Furat to come to him. When the 2 men were face to face, the governor said, I always had evil intentions regarding you. So much hatred do I harbor in my heart against you that I am always making schemes to capture you and banish you from these lands. But do you know what prevents me from doing so? For many nights now, I am seeing you in my dreams. You are always preventing me from reaching you, using a loaf of bread to keep me back. And when I order my guards to kill you, you fend off their various blows with a loaf of bread that is in your hand, so that neither blow nor arrow reaches you. Now tell me the story behind this loaf of bread. Ibn al-Furat said, O governor, ever since I was very young, my mother would come to me every night and place a loaf of bread underneath my pillow. Then, in the morning, she would give it away in charity on my behalf, and she never stopped doing so until she died. Then I continued to do the same myself, every night placing a loaf of bread underneath my pillow, and then in the morning giving it away in charity. The governor was greatly affected by what he heard. He said, By Allah, I will never even think about harming you after this day. I now think well of you and love you very much.
Who should I obey?
The school day ended, and the young girl returned to her home, but she wasn't her usual happy self. No, today a cloud of sadness covered her face. Her loving mother immediately perceived that something was wrong, that something was bothering her dearest child. She calmed her daughter down and asked her what was wrong. The young girl said, Mother, my teacher warned me that she would have me expelled from school if I continued to wear the long clothing that I always wear. But they are the clothes that Allah wants you to wear, said the mother. Yes, mother, but my teacher doesn't want me to wear them. Good point, my dearest daughter. Your teacher doesn't want you to wear them, and Allah wants you to wear them. Who then will you obey? Will you obey Allah, who has created you, given you your form, and blessed you with countless favors? Or will you obey a created being who has not the power to either benefit or harm her own self? Rather, I will obey Allah, said the girl. Good, my dearest daughter, for you are in the right, said the mother. On the following day, the teacher flared up in anger when she saw the young girl challenging her authority by wearing the very same clothes that she had prohibited her from wearing. She continues to reproach and threaten the child, until the young girl broke down crying, no longer able to show a brave face to the teacher and to her fellow classmates. When she would not calm down, but instead continued to cry, the teacher was bewildered, not knowing how to make her stop. Then the young girl called out, By Allah, I do not know who it is that I should obey, you or him. And who is he? Asked the teacher. Allah, should I obey you and wear what you want me to wear and make him angry in the process? Or should I obey him and disobey you? Indeed, I will obey him, subhanahu wa ta'ala, come what may. The teacher was struck silent, and on the following day, she invited the girl's mother to come and visit her. When the two were face to face, the teacher said, Indeed, your daughter has taught me the greatest spiritual lesson that I have ever learned in my entire life.
The Devil-Like Thief.
The events of this strange story took place in Al-Yamama, which is located in the middle of the Arabian Peninsula and which today is part of Saudi Arabia. It was the end of the first century of the Islamic calendar, during the reign of Al-Walid ibn Abd al-Malik. Times were hard in the town of At-Tihama, which was located in the region of Al-Yamama. For months, people in that town had lived in a constant state of fear and terror. They slept uneasily, and they were terrified when they would walk the streets. Each one of them was afraid that he was going to be the next in the ongoing list of victims. There wasn't any gang that was wreaking havoc on the town, nor a group of murderers that was prowling its streets. Rather, it was a single man who for months now was robbing people of their sheep and their money. Yet no one stopped him. In fact, no one even dared to stop him. One day, a group of hardy youths decided that if the authorities were not going to do anything, then they would patrol the streets and apprehend the criminal. The robber walked openly in the streets during the day and the night. Such was his confidence concerning his strength and cunning. When the youths confronted him, a brief struggle ensued, brief because the robber was able to take down his opponents with the strength of a lion and the skill of a trained warrior. The youths fled, and after news of what happened spread, no one else then dared to stand in the robber's way. People began to say, "Indeed, he is no regular robber. Instead, he is a devil wearing the garment of a robber." People began to spread strange stories about the robber, some of which were true, while others were false. He was the talk of the town, and the stories that were spread about him made him out to be a powerful, evil, otherworldly being. It is mainly because of those stories and the spreading of those stories that the town became seized by terror and fear. Even the guards and policemen of the town were frightened. News of the situation reached the ruler of Iraq and the East, Al-Walid ibn Abdul Malik. He was furious and could find no reason to excuse the impotency of his appointed governor in Al-Yamama. After all, how could he and the police force under his authority fail to apprehend a single man who made no attempt to keep his whereabouts secret? Al-Walid ibn Abdul Malik wrote a letter to the governor ordering him to kill the menace or to send him to the capital city as a prisoner. And he warned the governor that if he failed to capture the robber, he would replace him with a stronger and more competent governor. The governor of Al-Yamama actually knew who the robber was, and he even knew his name, Jahdar. But he felt bewildered concerning what he should do about him, because every single one of his police officers was either too afraid to go after Jahdar or too unskilled. However, the matter was now altogether different, for he feared losing his job. As is usually the case in desperate situations, desperate measures need to be taken in order to resolve the problem. And since all of his previous attempts to apprehend Jahdar ended up in failure, he realized that he now had to resort to trickery and deception. Having finally come up with an idea, the governor chose two of the strongest and smartest youths that he knew, and he agreed to pay them a lofty reward if they successfully brought Jahdar to him, whether in chains or in a coffin. The plan was simple enough, but its execution required both strength and cunning. They were to go and pretend that they were robbers like Jahdar. The plan actually held promise because Jahdar probably wouldn't recognize them since they did not live in Etihama, but in another town in the Al-Yamama region. When they reached Etihama, they asked the locals about Jahdar, and to their surprise, the locals knew where he could be found, though most of them had never actually seen him. The youths went to him and began to tell him about their background. They said that they were amateur robbers who had a few successes in stealing from others. They explained that they heard about his feats and bravery, and so wanted to meet him in person. They then proposed to work under him in order to learn from him his tricks and strategies. As apprentices to the master robber, they promised to give him a large percentage of every successful robbery. They said that they understood why he might be suspicious of them, but that he had nothing to fear from them. He could even test them for a while to make sure that they would remain loyal to him. Otherwise, if he refused, he would lose out because they would work for themselves and reap the rewards of their labors themselves without him having any share whatsoever. Jahdar was neither afraid nor suspicious, so sure and confident was he regarding his ability and strength. That confidence, which often served as his best quality, This time turned out to be a great fault, for Jahdar never imagined that any human being would even dare to challenge or deceive him. And so he accepted the proposition of the two youths, and thereafter tested their loyalty a number of times. He was, in fact, quite impressed by their skill and bravery, and they soon became a close-knit gang with Jahdar as their leader. They worked so well together that Jahdar began to imagine himself as soon becoming the richest of the rich in the Al-Yamama region. When the two youths were sure that they had gained the trust of Jahdar, they prepared to move into phase two of their plan, actually apprehending the scoundrel. They did not have to wait long for their opportunity, for on one of the ensuing nights, Jahdar fell asleep, and feeling safe under the protection of his two lieutenants, he put both his sword and his dagger at some distance from his bed. After all, why should he need any weapon while he was among friends? Pretending to be asleep as well, the two youths waited until Jahdar fell into a deep sleep. Every few minutes, they stole glances at him and at each other, fearing that he was aware of their plans or would catch them in the act. They felt that they had reason to fear, for on many occasions they witnessed the cunning and skill of their leader. But then finally, the older of the two signaled that they should take advantage of the opportunity. Moving with lightning-like speed, they took out two strong ropes and tied Jahdar's hands and legs. They tied his arms to his body very tightly, so much so that the tightness of the rope almost broke his ribs. It is then that he woke up with a start, looking around him with complete and utter amazement. As much as he tried to escape, his attempts were of no avail, for he was made completely immobile by the many ropes that were tied around him. Refusing to speak, perhaps from his anger and pride, he closed his eyes, as if in reproach of the two traitors. They tied a piece of cloth around his eyes so he could not know what was happening around him or what paths they were traveling upon. And despite the tension of the ropes, his silence and submission made the two youths more afraid than ever. They feared that his silence was tantamount to gloating, for perhaps he had one trick up his sleeve and would soon surprise them by freeing himself from his bonds and attacking them. Many long, intense hours passed, but finally, they reached the governor of Al-Yamama. Happy with their success and with the prospect of the huge reward that was promised them, and they were also happy to have finally saved the people of Etihama from a most devil-like robber. When he saw the two youths approaching with the prisoner walking before them, the governor let out a call of joy. "All praise is for Allah. All praise is for Allah. How brave indeed the two of you are. May Allah bless you." Of course, more than anything else, the governor was content in the knowledge that Al-Walid ibn Abdul Malik would be pleased with him and that his job as governor was still safe. Without wasting any time, the governor sent a rider to Al-Walid ibn Abdul Malik in Iraq with a message containing the good news. When the people heard that the infamous robber had been apprehended, they crowded the streets, each wanting to have a good look at Jahdar as he was being led through the streets in chains. Everyone imagined him to be a giant, a man with huge muscles, but when they actually saw him, they were shocked to see that he was skinny and of medium height. They also imagined him to look like the devil, but in appearance, he was clearly an ordinary man. Al-Walid ibn Abdul Malik sent the rider back with the message that Jahdar was to be brought before him. Jahdar was then transported to Iraq, and when he was taken to the court of the ruler for judgment, he was greeted, so to speak, by the faces of many army generals and ministers. all of whom wanted to see the man who had created so much mischief in Ettihama. Al-Walid gave the prisoner a long, hard stare, and he was surprised to see that, though the man had come to his imminent doom, he kept a brave face, showing no sign of fear. "Are you Jahadar?" asked Al-Walid. "Yes, I am Jahadar ibn Rabia. And what were your motives for committing your many crimes?" "The oppression of the times, the boldness of my heart, the emptiness of my pockets, and the cowardice of the people," answered Jahadar. Both his boldness and his eloquence, unusual in such a tight situation, made an impression upon the mind of Al-Walid. Al-Walid continued to question him, "Do you know what the consequences are of your actions? Were you to see me to be one of your soldiers, you would see from me many brave and impressive deeds," said Jahadar, avoiding the ruler's question. "You, one of my soldiers," said Al-Walid. "Indeed, robbers are only good at stealing, so do not have hopes for anything other than your certain punishment." But Jahadar did not give up. "Were you to witness my wisdom in difficult matters, you would see from me that which would please you," said Jahadar. To the surprise of everyone, Al-Walid said, "If you insist, we will test you." "May Allah honor the ruler. I will take on any test you have to throw at me." "But it is a difficult test that I have in mind for you," said Al-Walid. "Death is easier than it." "Let the ruler command as he pleases," said Jahadar. "It is not a test in the normal sphere of warfare," said Al-Walid. "I am prepared for any test," said Jahadar. "It is not a test that involves any human being," said Al-Walid, adding to the suspense. "Even if you pit me against a jinn, I will still accept the test." "It is not with a jinn." "O leader, from this moment onwards, I promise to be under your obedience. Test me with anything that you wish." "Then, here is your test," said Al-Walid. "I will put you in a closed area with a fierce lion, and you will have with you no weapon save a sword. If the lion kills you, and a painful death it will be, you will have received your punishment. But if you kill it, then we will have forgiven you. May Allah make matters well for the ruler, for the time when you will forgive me draws near," said Jahadar. "Do not be too hasty with your happiness," said Al-Walid, "for there is a surprise that will be awaiting you." Choosing the fiercest and strongest of lions, Al-Walid prepared the surprise, namely, to make the lion go hungry for 3 straight days, thus almost guaranteeing that Jahadar would not escape from it. Whether it was to make an example of Jahadar or for some other reason, the authorities informed the people about the situation and they were given permission to attend the event. On the appointed day, the weather was scorching hot, but people still came, not minding the heat or the huge crowd. Such an event, which might have been common in the Roman Colosseum, was quite unique for those who attended. The attendees despised Jahadar for his many crimes, but they felt sorry for him when they saw the lion roaring inside of his cage. The lion looked especially terrifying since it had not eaten for 3 days and had a look of desperation and hunger on its face. Al-Walid gave the signal and the lion was released. It sprang out, searching for its long-awaited meal. This lion was particularly huge, with a large head, sharp teeth, and blood-red eyes. Though they were safely seated outside of the closed arena, most people were terrified when they heard the lion roar, and everyone was sure that the skinny Jahadar was, in a matter of seconds, going to be torn to pieces. Then, Al-Walid signaled for Jahadar to be escorted into the arena. Perfectly calm and with an air of confidence, Jahda turned to Al-Walid and said, "May Allah honor the leader. This is the final hour. So, will I gain your pardon if I am victorious?" Al-Walid answered, "If you are victorious, then you will have indeed gained my pardon." Jahda looked straight into the lion's eyes, showing not even an iota of fear. It almost seemed as if he were hunting a deer and not a lion. The lion roared, but of the two, it was Jahadar who was the first to approach the other. He called out in a loud voice so that all could hear, "A lion and a lion, both in a narrow place, both strong and fierce." Contrary to what most had expected from the skinny prisoner, Jahadar raced towards the lion after letting out a warrior-like cry. When he came near enough, the lion leapt towards him. But with a stealthy and lithe maneuver, Jahadar was able to move out of the way just in time. By the time the lion was able to dig its paws into the ground and turn around for another attack, Jahadar was already upon it with his sword. He struck the lion with a strong but not lethal blow. In pain and angrier than ever, the lion bared its teeth and prepared for another attack. But Jahadar was too fast. He dealt a lethal blow to the lion's neck. Despising the man earlier for his crimes, the crowd now jumped to their feet in amazement and admiration. They wished that his bravery and intelligence could be used for good, as they were once used for evil. As for Jahadar, he wiped off the sweat from his forehead and walked towards Al-Walid, showing neither pride nor boastfulness in his comportment. The two shook each other's hands, and the ruler congratulated him for his bravery. Al-Walid made official his pardon of Jahadar, after which the latter made an oath to use his sword for good and not for evil. Once a major threat to the peace and stability of society, Jahadar now became its policeman and defender. He thereafter constantly strove to atone for his past sins and other than his civic duties. He also became known for his worship and piety. Thus, indeed, and in heart, did he strive to repent to Allah, the Most Merciful, for his past sins.
The potent effects of supplication.
Many centuries ago, a woman married a man named Ismail, who, having studied under the tutelage of Imam Malik, became a venerable scholar in his own right. One of the fruits of their blessed marriage was the birth of a son, whom they named Muhammad. Shortly afterwards, however, Ismail died, leaving behind a great deal of wealth for his wife and young son. The mother then took up the full responsibility of giving her son a good Islamic upbringing. She might have had ideas about her son becoming a noble scholar. But sadly, there was a barrier preventing that from happening. The boy was blind. These days, it is perhaps not so impossible for someone who is blind to pursue a higher education. Yet in those days, in order to become a scholar, one had to travel from country to country and from sheikh to sheikh, something that was, of course, difficult for a blind person. Yet the mother did not lose hope. With sincerity and a good intention, she constantly invoked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for help. Then, one night, while she was sleeping, she saw the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam in a dream. He said to her, "Indeed, because of your many supplications, Allah has returned your son's sight back to him." The woman woke up with a start, went to her son, and saw that the dream had come true. "How perfect Allah is! Indeed, He is the one who answers the supplications of those who are in need." After Allah blessed her son, Muhammad ibn Ismail, with the ability to see again, the mother set him on a course of studying and learning. Later in his life, that boy grew up to compile a book that is the second most authentic book in the world. The most authentic being the Book of Allah. The name of that book is Sahih al-Bukhari. Yes, its author's full name is Muhammad ibn Ismail al-Bukhari, whom Allah blessed with knowledge, a brilliant mind, and a retentive memory. The first step to becoming governor, giving away a bunch of grapes.
Verily, he who fears Allah with obedience to him and is patient, then surely Allah makes not the reward of the good doers to be lost.
To say that he became governor because of a bunch of grapes would be an unwarranted exaggeration. The grapes are merely representative of the path he chose in life. The path of generosity, truthfulness, and righteousness. His life, both before and after becoming governor, was characterized by hard work and sincerity. I am referring to Yahya ibn Muhammad ibn Habira al-Shaybani. Born in the year 499 Hijra in the town of Ad-Dawr, which was not too far from Baghdad, Yahya became governor during the rule of the Abbasi leaders, Al-Muqtafa li-Amrillah, and his son, Al-Mustanjid lillah. Before becoming governor, Yahya lived a life of poverty and humiliation, but he remained patient and content with his circumstances. And after he climbed the ladder of success and became governor, he did not exact retribution from those who had previously inflicted harm upon him. This alone proves the loftiness of his character, for the highest level of forgiveness is to forgive when one is able to exact revenge. One day, the police brought before him a man who was accused of murder. Yahya recognized him immediately, for they both grew up in the town of Ad-Dawr. When everyone, both the accused and the family of the victim, were gathered before Governor Yahya, Yahya agreed to pay 600 dinars as blood money to the family of the victim. When they left, Yahya gave 50 dinars to the accused and then ordered him to leave. He then turned to those that were seated beside him and said, "Do you know that I cannot see with my right eye?" They said, "No, we didn't know that." He said, "Indeed, I cannot see with my right eye. And the reason for that is the accused man on whose behalf I just paid blood money. Long ago, when I was once seated on one of the pathways of my hometown, I was reading a book on Islamic jurisprudence. Then the man you just saw came to me, holding in his hand a basket of fruits. He asked me to carry the basket for him, and I refused, telling him that that was not what I did for a living. He then struck me with his hand on my right eye. And from that time onwards, I never again saw anything with my right eye. A few minutes ago, realizing that I could now exact revenge upon him, I decided to repay his evil with forgiveness and kindness." On another occasion, a soldier entered into his presence. Yahya instructed his guard to give the soldier 20 dinars and to never again allow him to return to his office. Of course, those that were present were somewhat bewildered by what had just occurred. He said to them, "When I was in my hometown at Ad-Dawr, a killing took place which quickly precipitated into a feud with outsiders. Soldiers were sent into our town, and every man was rounded up and taken away. I, along with many others, was under the charge of the soldier whom you just saw. He led us away from our hometown, and of course we could not escape, for our hands were tied behind our backs. As we were marching forward, My companions began to offer money and valuable possessions to the soldier in order to ransom their freedom. One by one, he let them go until I was the only one who remained. I was in a very tight situation, for I had nothing with which I could ransom my freedom. He continued to lead me away from my hometown, goading me forward with his whip, which he often used to strike me violently. I remained silent and did not complain, but when the time for Asa prayer commenced, I asked him permission to allow me to stop and pray, but he refused my request. Yahya had instructed his guard to give the soldier 20 dinars as a sign that he forgave him for his harsh treatment, but had made it clear that the soldier was no longer welcome in his office, a sign that he could not forgive him for not allowing him to properly perform a prescribed prayer. Now, let us take a look at the road Yahya took, a road that led him from being poor to becoming a governor. In the town of Ad-Dawr, Yahya grew up in a poor family, all of the members of which were farmers who worked the fields. But Yahya was not concerned about farming or planting, no. All of his energies were expended on the pursuit of knowledge, reading and studying under the tutelage of learned scholars. When he was old enough, he left his home and traveled to Baghdad, where he studied the noble Quran, the sciences of hadith, Islamic jurisprudence, literature, and rhetoric. He soon became an accomplished scholar in all of those sciences, but particularly in Islamic jurisprudence and the Hanbali Madhab. He also became a renowned poet. Based on his accomplishments, Yahya began to look for a job in Baghdad. He went to a place that was essentially an office for government jobs. Every single time he went there, he was told that there was no opening available at that time. He probably would have continued to return over and over again had it not been for the fact that he was running out of money and could ill afford to remain in the capital city. Furthermore, he was beginning to lose hope of finding a job in Baghdad, and so he decided to return to his hometown. He left Baghdad after having spent his last dirham. Having no money with which he could rent a mount, he began what promised to be a long, arduous journey on foot. After he traveled only a short distance, the time for Asr prayer commenced. Although he was in an uninhabited area, he noticed an old masjid that was on the side of the road. Having entered it and having commenced his prayer, he heard a moaning sound coming from the corner of the masjid. And so, when he completed his prayer, he walked towards the sound of the noise, finding a sick man sleeping on the ground. Yahya put his hand over the man and found that he had a high fever. He asked him how he felt, and the man told him that his entire body was in pain. He also told him that he was a stranger and had no one to look after him, which is why he took refuge in that particular masjid, away from the city. Yahya asked him if he wanted anything. The man said, "I have a strong craving for a bunch of grapes." Yahya thought to himself, "Where am I to find grapes in this uninhabited area? Especially considering the fact that I have no money." Strange though the request was, Yahya decided that he was going to try and fulfill it, mostly out of compassion for a sick man who was now spending his last moments in this world and facing the first moments of the next one. "Perhaps he will supplicate to Allah for me, which will result in Allah providing relief for me regarding my sad financial situation," thought Yahya. Expecting no reward whatsoever from the sick man, Yahya went out to search for grapes. As I alluded to earlier, this was the turning point of his life. Yahya did not walk, but ran back to find a store on the outskirts of Baghdad. Finally, he reached a fruit store. and in it he found bunches of grapes. Taking a large bunch, Yahya said to the owner of the store, "How much is this?" He said, "One half of a dirham." Yahya said, "I don't have any money right now, but I will leave my cloak with you as collateral until I return with that amount." After the store owner told him that he was satisfied with the arrangement, Yahya took off his cloak and handed it over to him. Yahya then took the grapes and ran back towards the masjid. Finally reaching it just before nightfall, he made ablution, performed Maghrib prayer, and then offered them to the sick man. The sick man was extremely happy, and he ate all of the grapes, after which he said, "All praise is for Allah, who has provided me with what I have desired for a long time now." He then went on to tell Yahya his story. "I desired eating grapes for a long time now, but had not the money with which I could purchase any. You are indeed a mercy that Allah has sent to me. Now, my son, hear my story before I die, for I feel that I have only hours, if not minutes, left to live. My name is Ahmed, and I was a well-respected and successful businessman in Khorasan. I had a younger brother, Mahmoud, who was also a businessman. Approximately 1 year ago, we decided to join up with a caravan that was going to Baghdad. We intended to buy goods from Baghdad and then return to sell them in Khorasan. Before leaving, I purchased local goods, hoping to sell them in Baghdad, and then, as planned, to purchase goods to bring back home from Baghdad. My brother didn't buy anything, instead choosing to use his 1,000 dinars solely for the purpose of buying merchandise from Baghdad. Just before we departed for our journey, he gave me the money to hold for him as a trust, because I was older and was generally more responsible. We finally left, and everything was going well until we almost reached Baghdad. But then a group of highway robbers attacked our caravan, stole all of our merchandise, killed many among us, and injured others. I was among the injured ones, and as I lay on the ground, the robbers thought that I had died, and so they left me alone. I lay there, pretending to be dead until they left. Then I got up and searched for my brother among the corpses and among the wounded, but I could not find him.